Well, welcome to the latest episode in the IEA's Zero In series with me, Syed Kamal, the Academic Research Director at the Institute of Economic Affairs. In this series, we've previously been joined by academics, business people, and economists to discuss commitments to achieving net zero carbon emissions by 2050. And we've also looked at issues and solutions around the environmental agenda, from Pacuvian taxes on negative externalities to renewable energy to the fundamental question of whether targets are necessary or achievable. Is net zero carbon achievable by 2050? And is it the best way to clean up our planet? What are the free market or least interventionist solutions? What policy levers should be pulled or left alone? Well, today I'm delighted to be joined by Christian Bjørnskov, Dr. Christian Bjørnskov of Aarhus University in Denmark and IFN in Stockholm. Christian, thank you very much for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
I wonder whether we could start with the coronavirus at the moment. We are in the middle of lockdown in response to the coronavirus. Some call it a crisis. And we see governments willing to shut down large parts of the economy, fully aware of the economic cost. Now, at least in that comparison, and sometimes we've got to be careful about comparisons, you know, can we compare this to government's response to climate change? And are they being fairly unambitious when it comes to climate change? Is it a similar crisis or is it very different? And if not, would it warrant a similar shutdown of economic activity in order to meet some of those targets?
Well, first of all, let's be clear that we're using the word crisis in two very different ways here. The corona crisis is a crisis because what happened was very quickly. It evolved very quickly and it took us by surprise. The magnitude of the problems is not really different from what we've seen before. So for example, in 1968, the Hong Kong influenza killed almost a million people globally. So it's a crisis because it evolved very, very quickly and came as a surprise. If we talk about a climate crisis, it's a crisis that evolves extremely slowly because the global climate changes very, very slowly. And it's not at all a surprise. But the potential scope of the crisis is really, really large. So I think we should be very careful to know which sense we're using the word crisis in. That said, the problem here is that we might have to lock down parts of the economy to stop, or at least slow down the coronavirus. We can always discuss whether that was actually a good idea or not. We don't know that yet. With the climate crisis or climate change, the argument is that we also need to lock down some of parts of our economy because it's created by capitalism. And all of that idea rests on the misunderstanding that if we get richer, we use more resources. As economists, we know that's wrong, and we've known that for at least 70 years. The way most countries become richer, and the only way you can become richer in a long-run sustainable way, is to become more productive, essentially to create more value with the use of fewer resources. So at least from some point in our development, further economic development is actually going to leave us with a smaller resource footprint on the planet. So I think that's the main difference here, that there's absolutely no reason to lock down parts of our economy to stop climate change or to stop emissions. It's about getting the right kind of development and not stopping development.
That's interesting you say that, and you see that a lot of so-called environmental activists criticize capitalism. And they say that it's capitalism that's caused this. It's a crisis of capitalism. Yet at the same time, there's no real connection between whether it's capitalist or socialist. In fact, if you want direct comparisons, some capitalist economies are vastly superior to socialist economies in terms of their environmental record. Why do you think you see this affinity between environmentalism and socialism? What people call sort of watermelon politics, you know, green on the outside, red on the inside. Shouldn't environmentalists at least be neutral with regard to their politics or to the economic system?
I think the really honest ones are neutral. But the big problem is historically that after 1990, when it became blatantly obvious what the Eastern Bloc did or had been doing. And it became so obvious how much it polluted and how little wealth was actually created in the Soviet sphere of Europe. A lot of sort of hardcore leftists essentially lost their argument for socialism. It didn't create more wealth, it actually destroyed wealth. It didn't create more equality because everyone could see how politically unequal those societies were. And environmentalism was sort of the way out for large parts of the left wing, where they could argue that this is what our solutions do. So they actually had a set of solutions that were chasing a new problem.
It's interesting you say that. I remember reading an article about where did the left go after, or the hard left go, after the loss of legitimacy in Central and Eastern Europe. And I remember the paper said they went into two movements. They went into the environmental movement, so they could continue their sort of anti-capitalist message there. But they also went into the development movement and joined some of these developed NGOs so they could spread their anti-capitalist message to developing countries and found a home. So given that, how do we make the voice of those who are at least neutral or see a solution via free market solutions or via capitalism as the answer? How do we make those voices heard more?
Well, the first problem is that in all of kinds of these political decisions, you have what's called action bias. There's a beautiful episode of Yes Minister, where the prime minister says, well, we need to do something. This is something, so that's what we're going to do. He has to do something, or as feels as a politician, that he has to do something that's active and visible. And a lot of our solutions from a liberal point of view are really not activist and they're not visible in the same way. You're not likely to get votes immediately from our solutions. And I think one of our problems on the liberal right wing is that we need to communicate those things very clearly, that we might not have as visible solutions, and we can't say we're going to do this, this, and that. But our solutions, first of all, leave people free to experiment. So it's not always one size fits all. And they are much more effective in the slightly longer run. But communicating that to impatient voters is quite a challenge.
I can identify with that as a former politician. I remember there were times when I thought the best solution is to do nothing. This will sort itself out. But of course, you know, it was very difficult for me as a politician not to respond and say, I will write a letter or I will do this. I also remember a commission official at the European Commission who had studied under Hayek and said to me, sometimes the solution to some of these problems is to see how the solution emerges or a new order spontaneously emerges. He said, but I can't do that as an official because people expect solutions. Look, I wonder whether we can move on and talk, given what we were saying about the idea of the left and loss of legitimacy under communism, could you talk viewers through the findings of your 2018 paper, which was Do Liberalizing Reforms Harm the Environment, with evidence on post-communist transition? Could you talk us through some of the main points that you make in that paper?
Oh, sure. What I did was I looked at pollution and greenhouse gas emissions from 1990 onwards in the formerly communist countries, essentially because they start with a very, very similar political system and a very similar economic system and hugely polluting industry. It's all government-owned or government-run. It's extremely polluting, and it's certainly not a low-emissions industry. And those countries take very different routes. So, for example, the Czech Republic and Poland liberalize quite quickly. Estonia does it incredibly quickly. Others end up liberalizing much more slowly or at a later stage. So Serbia actually takes a long time to get going. And some of them, like Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, are almost stuck in the Soviet Union until this day. So it's a great example of where you have some very, very comparable countries that take different routes. Some of them become economically very free, The Czech Republic is one of them. Estonia is one other, where you develop strong property rights protection, independent judiciaries, relatively small governments, relatively little regulation, and others actually keep old-fashioned Soviet regulation. Some of them even regulate more. And what we can see there is essentially that in the very long run, the ones that move to an economically more free society achieve much more rapid reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. And they reduce them while they grow much, much richer. So a country like Poland today is almost twice as rich as they were in 1990, but they emit much less greenhouse gases today.
That's fascinating. How do we get that idea across as well? Well, how do we know? Or are we once again up against this bias that we see from the environmental movement?
We are up against the bias, but the thing is, everyone knows that real innovation is a trial and error process. Everyone knows that you have to try out things. Some things might work in one company or in one region where they don't work in other regions. And it's essentially the same once we're looking for ways to reduce emissions. We need to have a situation where people can experiment and where firms can try out things. And political solutions are always one size fits all. So Pigouvian taxes are smart ways of doing it because it just means that CO2 emissions are going to cost this much, period, and you can reduce them whichever way you want. But very often that's not the political route that governments take, because that's really the only route that they can take where they have no control of how governments do that. And one of the big problems is that even if you try to solve things in a smart way, you always have special interests trying to make you choose particular policies. So the incumbent interests, for example, be the Danish wind turbine industries, Vestas is here, Siemens is here, and so on. They have a vested interest in trying to force Danish politicians to subsidize a particular solution to the emissions problem. That's wind energy. So in that way, we would like everyone to experiment. But the political dynamics that we know from all sorts of politics, and it's not just energy, it's all sorts of politics. We know that kind of dynamic pulls us towards heavy-handed regulation and subsidies of very particular types of solutions.
That's interesting. You talk about heavy-handed regulation there, but you also talk about one size fits all. And there are moves, rather than the experimentation, as it were, and learning from each other, there are clearly a number of moves towards a global solution. So, and supranational institutions. I teach global governance and international relations, and clearly one of the areas that they there are movements in are the for a sort of global environmental governance, for example. What role do you see supranational institutions playing in terms of tackling the environmental problem? Where do you see the dangers in terms of one size fits all? And what lessons can we learn from these supranational institutions?
First of all, the one size fits all solution is a real danger when we talk about global or even just regional associations like the EU, because we can't even say that the same kinds of solutions apply to Wales and Scotland. So it would be very, very weird if the same solutions really apply and turn out to be effective in France and Bhutan. What they can do, I think, if they work really well, and the best example here is the World Trade Organization, is that they can enforce particular rules or regulations that would apply to all member states of the UN or the WTO or whomever. The WTO is actually fairly good at enforcing simple rules. And I think that's what would be the role for supranational organizations. That if you have a set of particular rules, you can use them to enforce them And you can't use a supranational government to for example, choose particular policies or choose particular technologies. It has to be very simple rules that are enforceable in global politics.
Let's turn to targets. We talk about institutions. The EU has set a target by 2050 of net zero carbon. The UK is a similar target. The debate seems to be around whether you bring that target forward from 2050 to 2045 or 2040. Can I just ask you your views, first of all, on the merits of the target? Is it also achievable? Is it desirable? Or what alternative policies might be advocated instead?
Well, one of the problems is that you have targets for CO2 emissions, but it's certainly not the only greenhouse gas, and it's not even the worst greenhouse gas. Water vapor is a greenhouse gas, and we don't tax that. So the targets here are misleading in the sense that everyone talks about CO2, but perhaps the biggest problem in North Germany and Denmark might be cows farting. Because methane is a greenhouse gas. I think very broad targets that seem achievable are a good idea to focus politics, and also they make the goal clear and foreseeable for everyone. So they actually, in that way, if targets are enforced in a clear and transparent way, they reduce the political uncertainty of those kinds of politics. But if you have a target like Denmark has, 70% reduction in the next 10 years, and the minister in charge of climate change, he's not in charge of climate change, of course, but he's responsible for change policies, admitted right away that he had no clue how to achieve that. I think that becomes laughable, and it becomes obvious that it's a policy target that is never, ever going to be enforced. So again, simple targets that are achievable can reduce policy uncertainty. More ambitious, complex targets actually achieve the opposite.
Once again, I remember in my time as a politician that companies would come to me and say, we don't particularly like this regulation or this law, but if you're going to make this law, however bad, get on with it and do it. So at least we have certainty. The thing we can't stand is uncertainty, because we need to be able to be able to plan for this. Look, in terms of meeting targets, whether they are achievable or not, or they are merited, what's your view on Pigouvian taxes, on especially a carbon tax? And why do you think some environmentalists have been so lukewarm towards a carbon tax?
Well, Pigouvian taxes are smart in the way that they just put an extra price tag on emissions, no matter how you do them. So if you're a company in Wales, you might be able to reduce emissions and therefore your costs in one way. If you're in Northern Ireland, you might do it in a completely different way. So Pigouvian taxes are smart in the way that they define a cost, not the way that you reduce that cost. So there's a lot of flexibility for single people, single companies, even single countries in choosing the right way for them to achieve reductions. The big problem, though, is that, and we've known that also since Arthur Pigou for 100 years ago, that once you have a tariff or a tax that's supposed to regulate behavior, so a CO2 tax is supposed to reduce CO2 emissions. It actually comes with two different purposes for every politician. The first purpose is to achieve the behavioral goal. But once you've done that, you actually get very little revenue from your tax. But the other one is that taxes are supposed to give you revenue. And that means that once you have for example, a CO2 tax, politicians will almost always set it too high. And if it's really effective in reducing emissions, they are going to have an incentive to raise it even more, because the revenue disappears from that tax. once the behavioral goal is achieved. And that's, again, back to the political dynamics here, that politicians always think of taxes as sources of income. So they actually defeat their own purpose in that way if politicians can't be kept to only one goal and not both of them.
I think one of the other problems we see about so-called carbon taxes is that they might be levied to try and affect behavior or change behavior. But quite often what happens, they're just seen by consumers as an extra tax. They don't see an offset or in another tax, a reduction in another tax. Is that maybe a better way of achieving carbon taxes? You know, that we introduce them to affect behavior, but at the same time, we get rid of another tax to show that it really is aimed at a specific problem.
I think that would be a good idea to do that, both to keep consumers free of extra cost, but also to signal that we're actually serious about this particular tax and we're serious about our goal. But that also means that we can't have exemptions. In Denmark, for example, we do have a CO2 tax, but the largest cement factory in Denmark is exempt from paying that tax. And the reason is that there are just a lot of jobs in that particular region in cement production.
Yes, and we see that all the time. Look, you and I are classical liberals. We are free traders. But one of the concerns about introducing taxes, particularly in our countries, is that if you introduce all these environmental measures and net zero carbon, companies simply move offshore, move their production overseas. Yeah. And that, so you don't actually achieve a net reduction in global CO2. And then what happens? We then import those goods. So one solution being proposed are carbon adjustment measures, or effectively green tariffs or import tariffs. What's your view on that? Is that part of a solution that free marketeers should be embracing and see that as the overall cost? Or should we see it as another a level of protectionism?
I think we should see that as another level of protectionism. And I think it's telling which countries really advocate these kinds of tariffs. It's the same countries that typically advocate protectionism, like Italy or France. The big problem is that even if you have these compensating tariffs that are supposed to avoid the CO2 leakage, essentially that production moves out of the UK and into Tunisia where they can pollute as much as they want, those tariffs, regardless of how effective they are in solving the emissions problem, come with all of the costs that we know from every other tariff on trade. They make us poorer, they reduce competition in our country, and eventually they kill some of the dynamism in our economy. And that also means that they kill some of the invention and some of the development that in the long run is going to give us new technology and low emission society.
Now, it shows how difficult this whole debate is. I mean, Bastiat spoke about the seen and the unseen. Hayek spoke about the fatal conceit of knowledge imperfect knowledge. Given all this, how can we adapt rational policies or set optimal targets when we don't have all the information? It's difficult to quantify the costs and benefits, particularly looking at decades ahead with various unknown unknowns. We don't know, for example, whether we complain about aeroplanes at the moment, but actually we'll have solar powered aeroplanes or electric aeroplanes with the energy produced by very green methods in the future. How do policy makers determine the optimal global temperature as well? And who should decide this?
Well, who should decide that? I have no idea. We hope that we can decide that in democratic politics, but sometimes democracies take awful decisions. Brian Kaplan wrote an entire book about that. I think the most important thing here is to know and recognize that politicians have no clue how to do these things. Again, we have to have an economically free society that delivers as much innovation as possible, because some of that innovation will turn out to give us some kinds of solutions that we have had never ever thought about. And it's exactly the unknown unknowns. It's very, very similar to entrepreneurship, where you, for example, see a country after a civil war. Rwanda is a great example, where they moved towards much, much easier regulations and fairly good property rights protection in Rwanda. And within 10 years, someone had developed a high-quality coffee industry. No one had ever really realized that Rwanda was a great place to grow coffee and to export coffee from. So it was an unknown, but it's one of the great success stories in that part of Africa today. And freeing up initiative is going to give us some kinds of solutions to some of these problems in the future, in particular if we're thinking about in the long term. We just can't tell people which solutions they are because we can't show them the wheel before we actually invented it.
It's interesting, you talked about the example of Rwanda. No one saw that. I have this amazing faith. Some people, my critics would say misplaced faith in human ingenuity. And where there's a problem, that humans will get together, entrepreneurs and others, and look to tackle that problem and solve that problem. Do you think that we underestimate human ingenuity when we're talking about how to tackle climate change or environmental problems?
Yes, I think we do. But mostly, actually, I think we underestimate the potential for human ingenuity because we don't really see the benefits today. So we take for granted that London doesn't smell of horse manure. But it did 100 years ago. It was a very unhealthy place 150 years ago. But no one really thinks about this today because we take the situation today for granted. In the US, everyone on the West Coast who's old enough can remember the situation in the early 70s where you couldn't put your washing out to dry in Los Angeles. It would go gray. It was so incredibly polluted in Los Angeles that children went into play because it was too polluted outside on summer days. But you have to have a certain age to somehow remember and recognize how far we've gotten with human ingenuity. If you don't do that, you simply underestimate how important it is for long-run development. And you come to believe that it's something else, that someone in Westminster or Copenhagen or Moscow in a magical way gives you more things.
Now, we spoke throughout this discussion about experimentation and seeing what works and in what context. But Christian, in summing up, as we come to the end of this discussion, I wonder if a Danish politician came to you, the Danish Prime Minister or the Danish Climate Change Minister came to you and said, Christian, you know, I've heard what you said. I think it's fascinating what you said on this IEA podcast. But what would you propose to me? How would you sum it up? How do we achieve these targets? How do we tackle some of the environmental problems? What would you say to him or her?
I would say that I have no idea how we're technically going to do that. But first of all, they should get out of the way. They should stop defining solutions. And instead defining rights. So property rights to innovations, patents or licensing or whatever, actually incentivizes firms to look for solutions. I think I will also tell them that even though they think that the airplane industry is horrible, it's actually a great example of the way competition works. So if you travel to the US in the mid-1960s, your airplane would probably fly something like it'll use about 5 liters of jet fuel per 100 seat kilometers. If you do it today, you fly on a Boeing that flies about three times as far on a liter of jet fuel. Yes. They have become vastly more friendly to the environment, even though we have more planes now. So my suggestion would be get out of the way. Define the framework in which we can have innovation of all sorts of things, and then accept which kinds of technical solutions come out of that.
Well, Dr. Christian Bjornskov, it's been a fascinating conversation with you, listening to a very Hayekian, classical, liberal perspective. Thank you very much for joining us. To our viewers and listeners, thank you also for joining us. Don't forget to check out the previous episodes in the Zero In series on our YouTube channel, IA London. You can also listen to the audio versions on Podbean. Also, at the same time, you can find all our online content on our website, ia.org.uk. If I could end with a small request to help us keep providing free content during these tough times, please do consider making a contribution, no matter how modest, by donating online at ia.org.uk. Thank you for watching or listening today, and I hope that you're able to join us again soon. Thank you.